Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be with you this afternoon. You know, a lot's happened, as we all know, in this world since I last spoke to you. With not only the pandemic that we were experiencing, but also everything else that seems to be moving very fast around us each and every day with what we see with going in this country. You know, I've lived 72 years and I've never seen anything like this, and I'm sure you haven't either. Not only things are happening in this world fast, but even in the church. Mr. Franks has told us, all of us, about all the decisions that they have had to make concerning the church, concerning Sabbath services, the feast, the holy days, many other things that go on and on, many decisions that they've had to change and make because of this virus. In Miami recently, we all know we lost Norman Nicholas, who we're going to miss very much. I remember the last time I saw her was when I was here on the Feast of Trumpets. And we know we need to remember to pray for Roy, her husband of almost 58 years. Continue to pray for Roy and their family members as they go through this difficult time. And I also don't know how many of you may know, but Fred Davidson and Mr. Charles Dickey, both elders in Cogwa who used to attend here in Miami, passed away this past, within the last month. And I knew Mr. Davidson very well and Mr. Dickey as well. This past year has been a tough year, though, in many, many ways for many of us. Even many of us have had family members who have contracted COVID. Maybe they haven't died from it, but they've experienced it. But I know my aunt's husband died from COVID just a couple months ago. And I know you probably know people that have also passed away from the virus. And we're all wondering, what will happen next? What will happen next? I listened to a sermon by Mr. Franks this past Sabbath. He made a surprise visit over to the St. Petersburg, Florida churches as he was coming to see his mother and his sister here in Florida. And he gave the sermon there in St. Pete. And his sermon was on what are we supposed to be doing as Christians as all of these events we see unfold in front of us and in our lives in our as we see these events happening. This past year, a lot of thoughts have been spinning around in all of our minds about the hows and the whys of this, why it's happening. Some have said end time prophecy is being fulfilled. Many years ago, we thought we were living back then in the times of the end. As I've grown up in this church, we've gone through different eras and times, but things seemed to us at the time, but we were wrong. Things seemed to settle down, but things have escalated here in the last few years. A few days before Thanksgiving this past year, my wife and I experienced something that seemed very mysterious to us that I have never experienced. It was about 9:30 at night in our home when we had gone to bed that I heard a loud crash outside my house. And at first I thought it was my neighbor getting something out of his shed. He's always out there doing something. So I didn't pay much attention to it. But I laid in bed and a few minutes later I heard more noises. So I got up. I walked, as you, many of you may know, I live in a two-story house. And I went out side of the master bedroom, and at the top of the staircase I turned the light on and I stood there and I listened for a while. I usually go downstairs, but this night I just stood there and listened. I didn't hear anything at that time then, so I went back to my bedroom and thought, well, it must have been my neighbor, and went back to bed. The next morning my wife and I had our annual physicals that we were scheduled to take at 9 o'clock. Well, we usually get up very, very early in the mornings. For some reason, we overslept that morning and we were running late. So we came straight down our stairs, Didn't go in the kitchen, didn't go anywhere, went out the front door and went to the doctor. But later on, when we came home, my wife said, "We've been robbed." And as she was looking through our glass front doors, we could see the back living room glass door busted out. We called the police, waited till they came to check the house out. And as I was talking to the policeman, it dawned on me at that time that the noises that I heard that night before was the breaking of my own glass doors in my living room that they came through, and that the glass had fallen onto the carpet there. Apparently the burglars, or burglar, I don't know what it was, had come in our house that night while we were upstairs sleeping. Not the next day when we were at the doctor's office, as we first thought. The burglars had gone through our downstairs rooms, opening cabinet doors, drawers, and whatever they try to find. We realized later that we had noticed the busted door that morning. We realized later that if we had have noticed the busted door that morning before we left the house, we would have surely canceled our doctor's appointments. For our physical checkups that morning, we would have canceled. My wife had not been feeling very well in the last few months, but had just assumed that it was the lack of energy and other things that were due to the lack of exercise due to this Florida heat and the COVID restrictions. But she had no idea that her lack of energy in those months was brought on by a reaction to an antibiotic that she had been prescribed, that she now knows she's allergic to, which was slowly reducing her iron levels in her body, attacking her red blood cells. Because the very next morning after the doctor's visit that we went to, the doctor called at 7:30 and says, "Get to the hospital immediately," because her blood count was very, very low. My wife needed iron infusions, she needed a blood transfusion, and spent about 3 days in the hospital trying to get her blood back to normal. Well, I'm happy to say, and thank you for all your prayers, but she's back to normal now. But if we had noticed that burglary that morning we were leaving, she would have not known what was wrong with her that time. She would not have known why she was so weak and how dangerous it was. And if I had gone down the stairs that night, as I didn't, but if I had gone down the stairs that night, I would have probably been confronted by the burglars at my home. The policeman told us that it appeared whoever was going through every drawer in our house was scared off by something. And that something was when they saw the light come on in the staircase as I was upstairs, as I turned it on. They exited out of the house the same way they came in. Well, looking back on all this and all that happened, we could find nothing that the burglars had taken. Yet they had definitely gone through my downstairs. Looking back on it was a good thing that I didn't go down those stairs that night. Also, it was good that we didn't notice the broken glass that morning, because we would have missed our doctor's appointment. For who knows how long before making another one scheduled doctor's appointment, we would have canceled that one, and we would have not finding out what was wrong with my wife. We would not have found out. When I was at the hospital, though, that day, the next day, I called Mr. Jackson about what had happened the night before and about what was going on with my wife. And the phrase came out of my mouth that sometimes, it goes like this, that sometimes I told him that God works in mysterious ways when he watches out for us. That's what I said to Mr. Jackson. God works in mysterious ways when he watches out for us. Well, that's a very popular phrase that has been said whenever things happen to people and they don't understand the whys and the hows of it. The phrase, God works in mysterious ways, is not in the Bible. It's not in the Bible. This phrase is assumed to be in the Bible, but it's not. It actually started from an old hymn, or actually from an English poet who wrote a poem, William Cowper, in 1773. And the first verse of that poem, which was later made into a hymn, says, God moves in a mysterious way. His wonders to perform, he plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. And the poem goes on and on and on. But brethren, does God work in mysterious ways? It's my question. And have you yourself ever said the phrase before? I know I have. I have at different times. I definitely said that when certain trials were, I was going through certain trials in my life, and we've all had our trials that we go through. Back in 1992 was a big trial for many of us in the church. We were definitely asking ourselves, why and how could this happen? That a hurricane was unexpected, and there was virtually no time to prepare for it. We were told that the storm was going to bypass Florida and go off of 100 or more miles off the coast and go up the East Coast. When all of a sudden, the Hurricane Andrew made a stop, a dead stop, and totally made a perfect left-hand turn towards the Florida coast. It changed course in the last minute and headed for South Florida. We were in church when that Sabbath, and we came home and heard it on the news what had happened. There was no time really to prepare, to get things ready. But in time, we could see God's hand working out things for all of us, and many lessons that we learn by going through that storm. Today, I would like to take a closer look at that phrase, does God work in mysterious ways? First, I'd like to ask you, what is the meaning of mysterious? The word mysterious. The dictionary defines this as mysterious as this. I'll read it to you. It means something that is difficult or impossible to understand or to explain. Something that is difficult or impossible to understand or even to explain. What did the Apostle Paul say about the subject? He mentions this. This is what he says to his people. He says, the Apostle Paul, over in Colossians 1, verse 25 and 26. You can turn there if you like. But the Apostle Paul wrote these words. He says, I became a minister according to the stewardship from God, which was given to me for you, to fulfill the word of God, the mystery which has been hidden from ages and from generations, but now has been revealed to his saints. Even though much of God's truth has been revealed, brethren, to us, there is much that can still surprise us in the details. We don't know all the details. We know God's plan. We understand that. Sometimes we can understand things in hindsight after they've happened, and we understand why. We understand why. So the things that once seemed mysterious were mysterious because they had been hidden from us for a long time, but are now being revealed as we are witnessing right now. We know that Christ spoke of such things as pestilence. In Matthew 24, he speaks of that in verse 7. But until the last year, we've never thought it would originate from a virus made by scientists in a health lab in China. Of course, behind it all, we know, is Satan, who is causing all of this. Satan is a very cunning and crafty spirit. And he is the prince of the darkness, as we know. He keeps his evil plans in the dark, doesn't he? And he keeps us in the dark for as long as possible sometimes. But God reveals himself to us through his spirit living in us and working with us, either before or after his plans are carried out. Now, there are many reasons why God appears sometimes to work in mysterious ways. And one of those reasons, I believe, why God seems to be working in mysterious ways is to show us that he is working in such a way that reveals who he is and that he is always in control. Let me read that again. That it reveals who he is and that he is always in control is one of the reasons. Many people in this world look to man's governments or politicians. I don't know how many are looking at too many politicians anymore, but they used to look to man's governments and politicians, which are failing, instead of trusting in God. And in the Old Testament days, over and over again, we saw it happen to the Gentile nations and to the children of Israel. People worshiping their idols instead of trusting in God. God wanted to show, if you remember, God wanted to show a young man by the name of Gideon. Gideon, who later became the fifth judge in Israel. Both the nation of Israel and Gideon needed to learn the lesson that God is always in control. And always they needed to learn again to trust God instead of idols. They needed again to learn that. Over and over they failed. Gideon was chosen by God for that very purpose. That very purpose. You know, there was a serious situation going on, as you may know the story, with the tribes of Israel. They had once again stopped worshiping God and began worshiping Baal. Baal was the ancient Canaanite god associated with agriculture. Baal was believed to be the giver of life. And Israel had been depending on Baal to provide what was necessary to sustain their farms, flocks, and herds. This Baal worship had been going on for 7 years, at least seven. Probably much longer. But for seven straight years, the Midianites and other Gentiles would come into Israel and camp nearby and destroy all the produce of the earth and leave nothing for Israel. Neither sheep nor ox or donkey. Finally, on the seventh year, the people of Israel cried out to God for help. Cried out to God for help. It took them quite a while to finally come to cry out to God for help, but it took in that seventh year. Let's pick up the story, though, and turn there to Judges chapter 6. Judges chapter 6. We'll begin reading in verse 11. Judges chapter 6, verse 11. It says this. It says, "Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under a terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash, the Abarites, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites, who were going to come and destroy it. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor.'" Here he is, a young guy, but he's calling him a mighty man of valor. "Then the Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?' So Gideon said to him, 'O my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house.' And the Lord said to him, 'Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man.' But Gideon needed proof, didn't he? He needed proof. And so he asked the angel, who he knew was the future Christ, the God of the Old Testament, to perform miracles, to prove who he was. And we know he did. He performed those miracles for him. So God instructed Gideon to destroy his father's idol of Baal. His father had an idol of Baal. And then chose an army from four of the tribes of Israel to battle the Midianites. Let's skip down to Judges 7, verse 2 and 3. Judges 7, verse 2 and 3. It says, "And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, "My own has saved me."'" God wanted him to recognize that he was the one that was going to save them, not by their hand and by their might, by this great army. "Now therefore proclaim the hearing of to the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead.' And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained." So there's still a lot of people, 10,000 people remained. I'm sure that Gideon and the Israelites found all of this very mysterious and didn't understand how it was supposed to work at all, how all this is going to work out. But the Lord wasn't finished yet. He said, "There is still too many people." 10,000 is too many. So we skip down to verse in chapter 7, verse 5. And this is how he eliminated the rest. "So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, 'Everyone who laps from the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lapped putting their hand to their mouth was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink the water. Then the Lord said to Gideon, 'By the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver you into the Midianites, into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place.' So the rest of the people left." So now Gideon is left with 300 men in his army to battle 135,000 people. Not very good odds, is it? I wouldn't want to be one of those 300. I guess you could say here that God definitely works in mysterious ways, but he's not done yet. Let's read God's battle plan for Gideon. And this is a pretty bizarre battle plan. In verse 16, it says, "Then he divided the 300 men into the three companies, and he put a different trumpet in every man's hand, with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers." Would you want to be one of those 300 men with the battle plan? But the point is that it wasn't the 300 men with their trumpets and their torches and their clay pots that won the battle that night. It was God. It was God. God in his mysterious ways. God had wanted Israel to trust him and no other gods. That's what he wanted. They wanted him to trust him. Verse 17 says, "And he said to them, 'Look at me and do likewise. Watch, and when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and say, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon."' So Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just as they had posted the watch. And they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands, just as they were instructed. Then the three companies blew their trumpets and broke the pitchers, and they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, 'The sword of the Lord and of Gideon.' And every man stood in his place all around the camp. And the whole army ran and cried out and fled. The whole army, says, cried out and fled. When the 300 men blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp, and the army fled. They began fighting amongst themselves. If we continued reading on, which we're not going to, but in chapter 8, it tells that 120,000 of those 135,000 men of the enemy died that night in that battle, fighting against themselves. And not one of Gideon's 300 men died. God had kept his promise. The book of Judges tells us later that Gideon judged Israel for 40 more years of peace. And Gideon's name is written in the faith chapter in Hebrews 11. God shows that he is in control. Put your trust in him and not in man or in idols, was the message. Another example of a way that God may seem to be working in mysterious ways is found in this scripture in Isaiah. Isaiah. You can turn there. It's Isaiah 55. Isaiah chapter 55. It says this in Isaiah 55, verses 8. And 9. He says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." That's one of the ways that may seem very mysterious to us, that God's ways and thoughts are much higher and greater than our thoughts. One of the minor prophets discovered this fact about God when he questioned God. He questioned God regarding why God didn't intervene during the terrible times and the imminent invasion of Judah by Babylon beginning in 605 BC. He is the prophet Habakkuk. We don't hear a whole lot about Habakkuk. Let's turn there and read this in Habakkuk in chapter 1. What Habakkuk was saying, Habakkuk is having this debate in the beginning of the chapter. He's having this debate with God and asking him, how can you allow a nation worse, as bad as Judah is, a nation like the Babylonians as an instrument against your own people? He was asking. And he was asking, how long will you not do anything? How long are you going to let this go on? Here in verse 2, it says, "O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you, violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble?" He saw what a botchery was going on in Judah. "For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore, the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, perverted judgment proceeds." A description of Judah. And everything that was going on, and Habakkuk was saying, "God, how can you allow all this to happen? Do something. Stop it." Now that was Habakkuk's question to God that day, and you can tell how much distress, as we read this, he was under as he witnessed all the evil that was going on with God's nation of Judah. And he was a frustrated prophet and actually asked these questions to God. He was questioning God. How can you allow this? Well, if we read in verse 5, a little of God's answer to Habakkuk back then. He says, "Look among the nations and watch and be utterly astounded. For I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told you." God is telling his prophet that he is in control. He is in control. I know what you're thinking, Habakkuk. I know what you want. But I'm in charge. I'm in control. And the very aware of what is going on in the nation of Judah. God is letting the prophet know that his thoughts and timing is not. The prophet's thoughts and timing, it's not Habakkuk's timing. And God assures him that he sees everything that's going on. And he even goes on in great detail about what his future plans are and at the right time. A smaller Babylon invasion began soon after this conversation that he had with God in 605 BC. But in 586, we know that Judah, the larger invasion, destroyed Jerusalem, had occurred. And many were taken captive to live in Babylon for those 70 years. So that means God gave Judah nearly 20 more years, a time to repent and to change, and they didn't. God tells Habakkuk in chapter 2, verse 4, he says, "Behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith." God sees the big picture and what needs to be done. Sometimes the answer we want is not the answer God gives us, is it? Sometimes the answer we want is not the answer God gives us. Or maybe it is the answer. But in God's timing, it will be done, not ours. What he does is not mysterious. What God does is not mysterious. But because we don't always understand until later, it only appears mysterious. Mysterious to us, but not to God. The important thing is to do as the prophet Habakkuk did. He remained faithful, and he stood as the watchman to Judah in those trying days, just as we also must do. There is someone else who also struggled with the mysteries of the wise. All those terrible things that happened to him personally. And we all know that person was Job. And all that he lost, his property, his children, and nearly his life. Job wanted to know why. Why? Job asked God in chapter 7. Chapter 7, you can turn there if you like. But it's chapter 7 and verse 20. He says, "Have I sinned? Have I done? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgressions and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust and you will seek me diligently, but I will no longer be." Job was in a state of depression, a great depression when he said that. So God answered Job by greatly revealing himself and his creation in those last pages of the book of Job. Several pages there we can read of how God's revealing himself. Chapter 38, though, in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Job out of a whirlwind, and he begins answering Job's questions with answers. Let's turn there to Job chapter 38. Job chapter 38. Job chapter 38 here, and beginning in verse 3, it says, "Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth?" So now he's putting Job on the spot. "Tell me, if you have understanding, who determines its measurements? Surely you know, for who stretched out the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God and the angels shouted for joy. He's presenting these questions to Job. And as far as we know, God never told Job the beginning of why all those things were happening to him in the very beginning. God and Satan had their conversation about it. But Job, in the beginning, was questioning why all those things were happening to him. We know because Moses later wrote this book of Job, but God did reveal many of the mysteries of his creation in the end of the book of Job, and to us as well, because it's written down for us to read. Job answered the Lord after hearing all his words and revealing many mysteries to him that Job didn't understand. He didn't understand these mysteries. Then Job answered the Lord in chapter 42. Let's turn there and read that. Chapter 42. The book of Job. In verse 42, it says, "Then Job answered the Lord and said, 'I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand.'" It was a mystery to Job. "Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, 'I will question you, and you shall answer me.' I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." Job understood the mysteries of why all this happened. Brethren, God has a plan for all his children. He has a plan for all his children. And that's what we read in Philippians 1, verse 6. It says, "Being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ." That means there's a plan for us. If he started a work in us, he's going to complete it. There's a plan laid out for us. And we know that God blessed Job, don't we? When we read the end of the book, God gave Job twice as much as he had before. And he gave him seven sons and three daughters. And he lived to be 140 years old. And he saw his children and grandchildren for four generations. God blessed him tremendously after what he went through. Yet, he didn't understand it at the time until God revealed the mystery to him. Just like Job, we may not actually know for sure why everything happens. Why is everything happening in our lives? But we trust that God is in control, don't we? We trust God's in control and is shaping and molding us as the great potter we read about. As the great potter. Going back to what I mentioned earlier in the beginning of my sermon, we have tried to think why we and others in the Miami South Area Church went through Hurricane Andrew and had to suffer all the losses that we did. Thankfully, none of us were hurt physically from that Category 5 storm. When it happened, we couldn't think of anything good coming from it, and we questioned God in our minds, why? Why, God? Kind of like Job, why? Why is this happening to me? In hindsight, nearly 30 years later now, I can think of a few things that came from that. There are many. There are many things that we learned from that experience. But the first thing is we learn that within just a few days is the love of the brethren in God's church. They came down from every Sunday from all over the state of Florida and brought food and clothing, and he came to work and help in any way that they could. They brought heavy equipment, even huge industrial generators to power not only our house, my brother's house, but some of our neighbors' houses. They brought and fueled it for months. They clean and move debris for many weeks. Over the years, I have run into people that say to me, I remember coming to your house and helping back in 92 when Hurricane Andrew hit. I was at the last conference and a gentleman came up to me and said, I remember coming to your house and helping out. You know, that's very moving when you hear those things years later. We learn to have empathy. We've learned to have empathy for people who suffer losses. When we hear about them, especially after natural disasters that we hear about that strike. And many this last season, we've heard about many hurricanes hitting the Gulf Coast. At first, we were like nomads, living in a motor home with a family of five for nearly a year behind our destroyed house. We ended up selling that house as is. And then we moved for a year to Atlanta area, thinking we might want to move permanently there. We met many new friends that I still know to this day. In the church, we got to see them and visit with them for the year that we were there and what it was like to live somewhere else besides here in Miami and to experience that. And then moving back in 1995, we got to experience all that happened in that year as well. And I think we all know what that was about. You know, my dad was a home builder when I grew up in Tennessee. And now I had the opportunity, through all the bad that had happened, I had the opportunity to build my home, a brand new home, about a mile from where my former house was. I would not have ever had that experience otherwise. And soon after that, God blessed us with good jobs. When we finished building our homes, we're almost at the end, we got a phone call. They wanted us to come work for a Toyota dealership, and we spent 18 years there working for the Toyota dealership. That's what I can see in hindsight, just a few things off the top of my head, but there are probably many, many other things that we can learn when you go through those experiences. But at the time, why God allowed it to happen to me and many others in the church back then was a mystery. But as far as I know, everyone who suffered loss at that time ended up much better than they were before. Let's look at the life of young Joseph. Young Joseph. I'm going to go over a little bit of his life. God had a plan for him. That's what I said. When God starts a work in you, he's going to finish it. He has a plan. He had a plan for Joseph. Joseph didn't know where it would all lead him one day. You know, it's interesting that the first thing we really read about Joseph growing up at that age of 17 years old, just a young teenager, is that he was what we would call a tattletale to his brothers. In Genesis 37, verse 2, we read that while Joseph was feeding the flock out in the field, I'll just read it to you, with his other brothers one day, he came back with a bad report of them to his father Jacob. I call him a tattletale, tattling on his brothers. So just picture this. He's a younger brother, and he was basically saying something against his older brothers to his dad. But we read in the next verse that Jacob admittedly loved his son Joseph more than all other of his children. And his other sons knew that because the Bible says in verse 4 of that chapter, after Jacob gave Joseph the coat of many colors as a gift, the brothers saw that their father loved Joseph more and hated him even more and couldn't even speak peacefully to him. That's how bad it was. And it didn't help at all when shortly after Joseph had those two dreams on two different nights that clearly showed that Joseph's parents and those brothers would bow down to Joseph in the future. And that was a straw that broke the camel's back. Very soon after that, his brother sold him, we know, to the Ishmaelites, didn't he? Joseph learned many lessons as God worked with him over the coming years. Now let's turn and read in Genesis 39. Genesis 39, verse 1. It says, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hands. So Joseph found favor. He found favor in the sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, it says. And all that he had, he put under his authority. Big responsibility. A good position. So it was from that time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hands, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Big responsibility. Turned it all over to Joseph. Things were going great. They were going very well for Joseph. But God was ready for Joseph to move on in his training at this point in his life. We know Joseph is taken to prison after Potiphar's wife falsely accuses him, don't we? He's put in prison, being accused. Potiphar's wife's accusing him falsely. We read next about his years in Pharaoh's prison in chapters 39. Let's go there. Chapter 39, verse 21. It said, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. God's still working with him, training him. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Now he has a big responsibility in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Despite him being in prison, God's still working with him. Yet Joseph doesn't know where it's going to end. We know that God was still working with Joseph when the captain of the guard in the prison placed Pharaoh's chief butler and chief baker under Joseph's care. Here, two men are introduced into the prison under his care. After the two men lost favor with their Pharaoh, and then we know later Joseph, with God's help, interpreted those two men's dreams they had. Skip down to chapter 40, verse 14. It says, after he had interpreted the dreams for them, and they were released, he said, but remember me when it is well with you. So now, Joseph is still in prison. He says, remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this place, this house. For indeed, I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews. And also, I have done nothing here that they should put me in this dungeon. He's pleading with them. Joseph is probably thinking, hey, I'm finally going to get out of this prison, because I'm sure he thought something good was going to happen after God gave him that interpretation to interpret those men's dreams. Nope. Didn't happen, did it? You get to stay here two more years, Joseph. Joseph probably saying, why, God? Why? I've done nothing. And the only reason that the chief butler even remembered Joseph at all is because Pharaoh had a dream And his own magicians, as we know the story goes, and his wise men couldn't interpret it. But the butler finally remembered when, hey, remember Joseph? He interpreted my dreams when I was in prison. And he told Pharaoh about it. And Pharaoh, he called for Joseph. They cleaned him up. And they went before Pharaoh. And he interpreted his dreams of the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine in Egypt. And as a result of that, we know that Joseph was placed second only to Pharaoh in Egypt to build great storehouses. Joseph was now 30 years old. 30 years old. We finally end the overview of the life of Joseph today with what he said when he met his brothers again. When he met his brothers again. Joseph was about 39 years old at that time. And he looked so Egyptian in dress and language that they didn't even recognize him when Joseph's brothers came. They didn't recognize who he was. But Joseph instantly recognized his brothers. We don't know what those 17-year-old Joseph might have done to his brothers now that he is age 39. If God had not molded and shaped Joseph in all those years for his calling as second in command in all of Egypt for a purpose. Joseph didn't even know how far his brothers went after selling him to the caravan to Egypt. He didn't know that they tore his coat up and smeared blood on it with goats and presented it to their father, Jacob. And they let him think that Joseph was eaten and attacked and killed by a wild beast. The Bible records that Jacob would not be comforted by his children and said he would be mourning Joseph's death all of his remaining years. That's how traumatic it was to him. And the brothers let him grieve and never told them the truth. Their brothers had very good reason to be afraid now before when they stood before their brother Joseph, what they knew they had done. But this Joseph is a different Joseph. He's full of godly wisdom and compassion. And Joseph said this to his brothers, a famous scripture we will read in Genesis 45. It says, then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried out, make everyone go out from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Very emotional. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. So they came near. Then he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. What an attitude Joseph had here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. God sent me. For these 2 years of famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and Lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. During Joseph's life, brethren, there were many things God did that were very mysterious that Joseph did not understand. But it appears he had figured it out, most of it, when we read these verses we just read. Brethren, God is not finished working with any of us quite yet. And as we enter this year of 2021, remember this. God tells us that He will never leave us nor forsake us. You can take that to the bank. He will never leave you nor forsake you, no matter how bad things may look with this, what's going on around us. Sometimes things do seem mysterious, and God seems to be working in mysterious ways at times because we don't clearly understand. We don't understand God's mind, but He has revealed His overall plan, His truth to us, and we will remain His watchmen in faith that God's will be done.